The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Grace Dillon, editor at ExchangeWire, and joining me as our very special guest this week is author and web psychologist Natalie Nahai. Hi Natalie, it's great to see you.
Hello, nice to be in conversation with you.
Wonderful to have you. We're very excited to get your perspective on these stories. And also joining me as our special guest, as always, is Matt Broughton, research lead at ExchangeWire. How are you, Matt?
I'm good. Thanks, Grace. How are you?
I'm good. I caught myself there on your new job title. I haven't used it on the podcast yet. So,
well, it's better than John on stage pronouncing me as Broughton. So job title, I don't mind.
Well, that's all good. That's good. Well, we've got some great stories to discuss. So we'll dive right in. Starting with Linda Yaccarino has officially become CEO of Twitter after taking the reins from Elon Musk last week. In her first memo to staff, Yaccarino called on the social media platform's employees to help launch Twitter 2.0 and stated that the company is on a mission to become the world's most accurate real-time information source and a global town square for communication. While such ambitions will not be easily met, some commentators remain optimistic about Yaccarino's appointment. The former NBC Universal chair of advertising sales' successful track record could turn things around for the ailing social media network, which has fallen out of favour with advertisers since being acquired by Musk last year. According to reports, Twitter's top 50 advertisers have significantly reduced their spending on the platform, and ad revenue overall has declined by an estimated 28% since 2022. So, I mean, we had a bit of a discussion on the podcast a few weeks ago with Josh Sternberg from Morning Brew about about the story when it was first announced that Linda Yaccarino had been appointed. She's now taken the reins. The general consensus from their discussion was that as long as Elon Musk was around, you know, Twitter's fortune may not really turn around or you know recover as some might hope, but Linda is now in the driving seat, as far as we know, and has a very, very lofty ambition for the platform. My first question with this story really is, do you think that Twitter 2.0 is possible? And do you think that advertisers will actually buy into it? We've seen, you know, such a mass exodus of advertisers from the platform, but do you think they will return? Matt, I'll start with you on this one.
It's an interesting one. There's a lot of what I would call corporate hype speech in Yaccarino's memo. When you start by wrapping your arms around this powerful vision, literally everything is possible. But there's not too much in terms of the actual meat and gravy as to what Twitter 2.0 really is. Though what is clear is that they will continue down the road that they followed since Musk came on board, down that road of minimal content moderation, which carries a risk to advertisers, which is why we've seen such a dramatic drop off in ad spend on the platform. However, Twitter's been looking to counter this by partnering with third-party ad tech providers, you know, the likes of DoubleVerify, Zephyr, IAS, to try and counteract that and make it as brand safe as possible while keeping that kind of open forum approach. And I think that could go either way with advertisers. Brand safety scandals involving the likes of YouTube and Facebook have shown that brands can be forgiving of environments that are compromised in terms of brand safety. And I think, you know, Yaccarino's far, far less likely to be as inflammatory as Elon Musk, who, today announced he wanted a cage fight with Mark Zuckerberg. So I don't think we're going to see Yaccarino doing that. But I think on the flip side of that, where brands have been forgiving of those platforms which haven't previously been brand safe, it's generally come from positive action from those platforms, such as YouTube taking down videos, inflammatory videos, and more strictly monitoring uploads, for example. And I'm not sure how much leeway Twitter has in terms of time for that, obviously given the financing deals that Musk had to broker in order to buy the platform for such a lofty fee in the first place.
Natalie, what do you make of this? What do you make of Linda's memo and her kind of mission to transform Twitter into Twitter 2.0? Is it possible? Do you think that brands are going to, you know, rally around it and return?
The thing that really struck me about the piece that you just kind of offered in terms of contextualizing what they're hoping to achieve is how much there is an inconsistency between the two lines that they're plotting out there. So one is, let's get advertisers back onto the platform, so presumably we can make loads of money advertising to folks. And the other, which is we want to be the town square and kind of like a almost like a verified source of information for people all over the world that's beyond reproach. Those two lines are completely, in my view, incompatible because you've got a revenue model that exists upon the platform's ability to engage people. And we know from psychological research that emotions that tend to be more inflamed, such as righteous anger or fear, tend to be the ones that propagate content most quickly and at greatest scale. How is that compatible with creating a town square in which people can access balanced information that has been vetted? I mean, these two things are completely opposite approaches in my view. And so I think from that perspective, they have to pick a race that they want to be in. And clearly, if you're a platform and you want to make money, the advertising motivation is going to be the primary winning motivation. So in that case, be clear about that and don't pretend to be something that you're not. And I say this with like a lot of affection for the early days of Twitter, where it was this extraordinary place where you could come together, have robust, respectful discussion. And we're now living at a moment in time in which there are a lot more risks for being clear and outspoken or asking difficult questions, and a lot more to lose by engaging in the kinds of robust conversations that used to be had in the early days. So we're in a very different moment in time. They clearly want to sort of create more revenue through creating this new sort of Twitter 2.0. I don't have a lot of optimism about it. I think every platform and system has its life cycle. And my kind of tuppence worth is that this one is now on the downward swing and people are migrating elsewhere. But that might be just a very subjective experience. I've fallen out of love with it.
Well, I don't think you're alone. I mean, we've had so many, I mean, anecdotally, and we've seen, you know, stories of users leaving as well. It's not just, you know, the advertisers who are going. A lot of people who were really involved in Twitter in the early days and really active on it are moving away from it. And we're kind of being left with people who are more inclined to kind of get involved in more maybe outrageous conversations or worse even. You know, so it is a case of, as you've said, you know, we've had a shift in attitudes and the times that we're living in have changed so much that not just from an advertising perspective, but from a user perspective, is Twitter really that exciting? Is it really that engaging? And I suppose my next question is, do you really see, you know, users and individuals kind of coming back to the platform? I mean, we're seeing a lot of excitement from brands and advertisers because, you know, Linda Yaccarino, who's been in the advertising industry for a long time and had a lot of success, is coming back. But do you think the users are really going to be that sold about it? And is it really going to draw them back in? Or have we got to a point where Twitter is just going to peter out because the users who sustain it aren't there anymore? What do you think, Matt?
It's an interesting question. I don't know off the top of my head how, obviously we've seen, you know, lots of stories, lots of comment about how, you know, advertisers have been, you know, spending less on the platform. But in terms of users, from what I know, that's been relatively consistent. Obviously, you know, in, you know, times like this, they're still looking towards growth, but I think we haven't seen a dramatic drop off yet. But I think without that growth, it may be, you know, consistency for the next 2 or 3 years, and then it'll start dropping off as people abandon Twitter for more hyped up and interesting platforms. Obviously, we've seen TikTok receive the lion's share of interest and hype around social media at the moment, and it's a case of what gap is Twitter filling by being this open form of communication that the likes of Facebook, Instagram, TikTok aren't filling. And I think having this kind of more open platform communication, I think, you know, Twitter, you know, previously before the Musk acquisition, they were looking to branch out to different products, and a lot of those were interesting and more sort of subscriber based, but now they've had to pivot back to the advertising side of things. And it's a case of, I'm not entirely sure what niche and gap they're filling at the moment.
Especially when you see so many of the folks that were early adopters that were kind of the, you know, when you think about the Twitterati, these sort of journalists, literary types, a lot of those folks have migrated over to Substack. They've got their own models. They're making their own money. People have moved to podcast, long form content, Patreon based financial models. A lot of people who are sharing information from a business perspective now are populating LinkedIn feeds. There's closed groups. There's kind of the social cooling effect where people have gone into more federated forms of engagement. So private WhatsApp groups, which is, you know, massive for Meta, Telegram, Signal, these are all burgeoning. You've still got a very active tranche of people on Mastodon. Then you've got your Instagram and TikTok, which is a different kind of consumption and creation of content. So like, I don't know what niche Twitter holds anymore, because a lot of the things that made it valuable have kind of dispersed to other platforms where there are perhaps more closed walled gardens where you can actually have conversations in a more generative context, so to speak.
And my kind of final question with this story before we move on, because I mean, we could speculate endlessly about Twitter's future or lack thereof. But my final kind of, you know, area of interest here is when Linda Yaccarino was announced, you know, Musk kind of reiterated this desire to turn Twitter into a kind of, you know, an everything app, he wants to call it, you know, the X core or X app. You know, we've seen in Asia Pacific, there's been quite an uptake in, you know, utility apps that, you know, provide a range of services and such, but it's not something that's really taken off in other regions, in kind of Europe and North America. Do you think that it's something that could, I mean, come about? But even if so, do you think it's realistically something that Twitter could evolve into? Or do you think there's not really much of a user appetite, if not for a utility, super utility app, then at least not for one kind of that came from Twitter? What do you think, Matt?
I think there possibly is the appetite, and we've seen, not necessarily in terms of the, you know, vastly scaled super apps in the APAC region, but definitely in terms of more niche, well, how to phrase them, niche super apps. Obviously, we've seen the likes of Uber in terms of transportation, Meta in terms of its communications platforms. But in terms of if Twitter did want to build that scale, then it needs a hell of a lot more capital to do it. And I don't think that's something that Musk and Twitter have access to at the moment, unless they, you know, really ramp up the advertising revenues, which, as we've discussed, is going to be a very strong challenge for them.
Definitely. Natalie, what do you think about this?
So during Mobile World Congress, I was at an event hosted by Braze, and there were some folks there talking about Meta's progress, especially in India, of providing multiple utilities through the WhatsApp platform. And the interesting thing about that is that WhatsApp as an experience for users is a utility. Like, it's something which you already use every single day. It supersedes the native messaging apps that people have in their devices. So imagine, like, the friction it takes to switch over from a native app into something that is a third-party app. That's already massive. They've overcome that. They're already in people's hands and minds as something which is the easy, frictionless experience to go to. I don't see how Twitter would either redirect existing users to then adopt these new platforms or apps or utilities, and then also bring people back who've left or who've grown silent. You know, if you're talking about users, I count myself as a user of Twitter, but I'm not an active user. So there's also, like, how many people are actually actively engaged? And then in the third sort of wave of users, how can you get people who are not using Twitter to jump ship from whatever other existing utilities they're on to come over? I just think psychologically, the incentive is already, it is going to be tricky for them to sort of pinpoint the incentive for people to move, because I think those needs are already being met elsewhere. So I don't really see it taking off. I see it more like a kind of, you know, so it's in the kind of like the MySpace years of its existence, and we're just kind of watching it fade away. And it's quite sad to watch, but we're in a different age. Other apps are available, platforms, and maybe that's just the way it goes.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, who knows what the future will hold, but it has looked brighter for Twitter, we'll put it that way. But we will move on and we'll discuss our next story, which is that generative AI tools will not eradicate human creativity, but complement and enhance it, argues futurist Bernard Maher. Protocols such as DALL-E and ChatGPT could make artistic pursuits more accessible to more people by being used to address the mundane tasks or resolve the obstacles that can accompany creative endeavors, such as a lack of time or technical ability. Moreover, their capacity to process vast amounts of data means that AI programs can generate new ideas that inspire humans to create works of art that they may never have thought of before. Marr asserts that the human element of art will remain intact because only people can provide the context that gives a piece of work meaning. However, creators must be conscious of the risk of unintentionally infringing on someone else's copyright, as the citation of original sources and attribution is severely underdeveloped within these protocols. Similarly, the matter of authorship and ownership is still blurry, as the new ideas generated by AI will have been drawn from existing works created by other people. So, an interesting thought piece. I can't say I'm convinced by it entirely. And I did have to balk at Bird of Mars' description of Shakespeare's catalogue as a mere 39 plays. I mean, that was quite staggering. I don't know if Mr. Mars tried to write a play, but it's very, very hard. I've tried, and you know, the idea that I could do one, let alone 39, is staggering. So mere, I think, is a bit ungenerous. But anyway, there's a lot to unpack here. Natalie, what did you make of this opinion piece? Do you agree with it? Do you you know, have some qualms with it? What do you think?
I have so many thoughts on this. This is such an interesting area of debate. So when I came to Barcelona 6.5 years ago, it was to actually undertake what has since become a 3.5 year course in realist arts, in oil painting, the way that old ateliers would have done. And so I have a lot of skin in the game when it comes to the role of AI in creativity, art production, the creative process, etc. So there's a couple of things. I think one of the things that gets talked about a lot, so he's talking about automating specific tasks. What's fascinating from an art historical perspective is that old masters such as Da Vinci or Michelangelo would have been trained in workshops, so an atelier method where other people are also completing parts of a specific painting under the guidance of like a master, basically. And so people would paint for masters, automating the process by getting individuals to complete the bulk of the work before the master comes in and tweaks, not dissimilar to the way in which we might give a bunch of prompts to AI and then come in and adjust at the end, except the fact that the master would have learned the skills to be able to produce these things from the ground up. So there's an interesting element there about automation, that it's not new. People still use it today, but it removes the human factor. Then there's another question around process versus output. And there's this wonderful idea that the artist makes the art and the art makes the artist, by which I mean that in the process of conceiving of an idea, sketching it out, working through it, engaging in whatever form of art it is, I'm a painter, so I'll speak from that perspective. As you paint, the painting itself begins to have an impact on how you perceive, how you sense, what you're feeling needs to happen next in the painting. So it's this interplay between the object which you are creating and its subjective impact on you. And so there's kind of something there around this kind of entwined, entangled journey that results in the finished piece. So it's not just about output of content, which is generated from a bunch of training points. So there's two other things I think that pull to this. There's chaos and order and then spontaneity. So chaos and order, when we're talking about the ways in which art is created, we're not just drawing upon the training data of our lived experience as individuals within societies and the wider web of life. We're also drawing upon the ineffable. So our heredity, our creatureliness, the mystical archetypal forces that characterize the human story, whether they're factually real or not. We have stories about how we've come to be, etc. And so we're actually embedded in narrative and rooted in stories. And these stories that we create together and alone help us draw threads of meaning throughout our lives to those that have come before, our ancestors, and those who come after us. And that kind of narrative allows us to make sense of chaos, of interrelationships between others. And that all pours into our ability to create art. Which leads me to the last point, if you'll indulge me, around spontaneity, right? So for humans, creativity can be thought of as a novel combination of existing factors rooted in the biological ecosystem that we call the self. This is kind of my perspective. And we're not just biological. I think there's other elements too. But as individual humans, we are ourselves ecosystems. So we have our microbiome, hormonal cycles, the stage of life, so how much time we feel we have left, that will influence what kind of art we create. The food we ingest, the upbringing that we experience, the culture we're embedded within, whether we're ingesting certain chemicals like psychedelics or coffee that alter our states, the environment, the relationships, there's this melee of factors that contribute to our subjective experience of the world, often in very subconscious ways. And it's the interplay of all of these factors plus sort of, you know, randomness of the universe and our conscious thought that gives rise to what we create. We are so extraordinarily complex interbeings. And I think that because we have a biological basis to our experience, there is fundamentally a difference between what electronic systems can create and reproduce based on the output of all our processes versus the subjective experience that an electrical system has to go through in order to create the output. So the systems, even though they output similar things, the processes are fundamentally different. And so then can they actually ever generate anything remotely similar in kind of, I guess, subjective quality to that which humans can create? So those are just some of my thoughts. There are more, but I don't want to... I've been thinking about this a lot, you can probably tell.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised. It's been such a massive shift in creativity and in, you know, things that for you know, millennia have been perceived as exclusively human, really. So it's a massive change, and there's so much to really think about. And I think maybe part of people's fear about these technologies is people not thinking about these things and how, you know, these protocols are kind of potentially overwriting things that are so essentially human. Mm. So it is a big deal. It's a lot to talk about. And, you know, our CEO, Rachel, was saying a few weeks ago, it's a shame that we never really talk about, you know, the kind of philosophical elements of AI. So it's great to actually talk about it here on the podcast today. I mean, Matt, what did you make of this opinion piece, and what do you kind of think about what Natalie said about the differences in process and how that impacts art? You know, is a piece of art just the product, or is it the process?
Yeah, I mean, there's no way I can sum this up anywhere near as half as beautifully as Natalie just did. But from my perspective, the point I keep looping back to in my mind, like, on the one half, yes, I agree with the point that raised in the article that, you know, AI could be used to democratize creativity, and people who don't have access to years of training or, you know, high-end materials, you know, it could give them an avenue into producing pieces. But I think that has to come from, as Natalie said, from that personal, you know, that idea, that lust to create something rather than just, oh, I can type something in. Oh, look, a pretty picture. That, you know, art isn't about efficiency. And that's the point I keep coming back to in my head. And I think on a bit of a tangent where this is quite interesting in terms of, you know, a contextual news story, you know, there's been a strong pushback in the news today against the opening credits for a new Disney series Marvel Secret Invasion, which the opening credits were produced by AI. And obviously there's huge debate at the moment in terms of the writers' strikes and the role of AI in creative processes where it comes to obviously corporations producing them. And having looked at the opening credits, my main pushback against them is that they're a bit shit. Like, they look like pasted together snippets from Google's Deep Dream project, which was out in 2015. It looks like we could have cobbled together them together from that. And I think the lessons from corporations involved in creative processes, like Disney, for example, if you're going to use AI for efficiency, do more with it afterwards, not less. Don't just leave it at that. Use the creative brilliance of your VFX teams to kind of hone that almost storyboard vision, which is what it looks like. It looks like an initial draft rather than what should be a published opening credit scene. Use that, you know, creative brilliance within your teams to optimize it, to hone it, to really make it pop and make everyone go, wow, this is something new and something brilliant. And that to me is art rather than, oh, this is AI. It's a bit shit.
I'm thinking, kind of bring this back a little bit, you know, a lot of concern obviously has surfaced around, you know, creative jobs, as you've just said, you know, with the Disney example. you know, that's a situation where, you know, people are on strike because they want to improve their job situation, and we're seeing AI being brought in to take over. I mean, we saw in Germany this week that Bild has you know, cut a lot of jobs and are replacing a lot of their editors and proofreaders with AI. So, you know, there is, we are seeing a few instances where this is happening already, and there is concern about, you know, job losses and job cuts, where people will be replaced by these programs. You know, do you think that, kind of thinking of, you know, of Bernard Maher's opinion piece and kind of what we're seeing, do you think that there is, you know, the potential for a lot of the kind of the creative work within advertising to be taken over by generative AI? And how do you think that will affect kind of the industry going forward? Natalie, what do you think?
So this is interesting. I've been watching various kind of memes, short videos of kind of market folks, designers, watching Diffusion, Stable Diffusion, or, you know, DALL-E, or, you know, Bing's AI, which is built upon the OpenAI system, come up with convincing first draft ideas for specific campaigns, and the look of dread on some of these people's faces. And it absolutely is going to change the game. I mean, I think if we think about the fact that our economic system is predicated on growth and profit, if that's your primary directive, you're not going to give a flying monkey how many people you employ or don't employ. The main primary directive will be, how much money can we make? Where can we cut our losses? And I think there's something really myopic about the decisions that are made, where you're essentially gutting an entire economy and causing, and this, again, this is an area for much debate, because it might be that a whole bunch of other jobs open up, like we've seen in previous revolutions, tech revolutions, industrial revolutions, etc., where then people can reskill and migrate to different jobs. I think AI is possibly different in this, because it's doing a lot of the creative work, thinking work, procedural work, aggregating work, research-based work that previously would have done in those previous revolutions by humans. And so if there are areas which AI becomes good enough to provide a superior service at a fraction of the cost than humans, which I would say is pretty much all areas of life, perhaps except care, what does it mean when you've got the majority of humanity out of work if our system still relies on capitalism and the exchange of a proxy for value, which is money, and most people can't earn that, and then you end up in the territory of universal basic income and credits? And I don't know. I mean, I think the questions that you land at become much deeper and much more existential very, very quickly. So I think there's a question around, what are ethical companies going to do? Are there enough of them that will put in, I guess, guardrails that enable them to pursue profit, but not at the expense of people? And this is where things like the B Corp movement have something, you know, potentially to say about it, or cooperative. So I don't know. It's a really complicated question, because it involves so much complexity and competing motives.
Matt, what do you think? And I mean, we are seeing, sorry, just to kind of add on to that, you know, we are seeing more discussion among lawmakers and regulators to, you know, try and address some. I know a lot of it's around misinformation, primarily, really, rather than kind of the impact on jobs, although that is another point of consideration. But Matt, what do you think about, you know, AI's potential to kind of take over these creative jobs, and how will that kind of shape the industry going forward?
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting question. And to echo Natalie, there's so many different facets of it, so many different areas you could go into to with it, to kind of bring it back to that Bild story in terms of, you know, replacing editorial staff with AI. I'm not entirely sure how much of that is just trying to put a bit of salad dressing on having to make a round of layoffs anyway, and trying to put a positive spin on that. But obviously, as a content writer, as a journalist, it's quite terrifying in a sense, because, you know, those positions they talk about, you know, the copy editing, the sub-editorial positions, that's how a lot of people, myself included, that's how they got into the industry. And I think to remove that bottom rung of the ladder, how do you then break into the industries? And I think on the one hand, that's obviously, you know, raising a lot of questions. How do you support people getting into different fields? Will that lead to, you know, people having to go down more routes of specialized education, which is obviously, you know, comes with a cost? On the flip side, in terms of what it could bring, obviously, in terms of generating new jobs. I think in terms of journalism specifically, I think we're going to have a lot more specialists where, you know, specific subtleties of their particular purview, they're going to be more expert on that than, you know, the more generalist AI systems would be. So I think there will be, you know, in journalism and in a lot of other fields, there will be a lot more specialization, I feel.
Yeah, reading the Built story and looking at the list of jobs they've cut and looking at my LinkedIn profile and seeing my skill set, I just thought, oh dear. But yes, I mean, it's such a huge landmark shift, as we've said, and it's just going to keep evolving, and we'll obviously talk more about it amongst ourselves and in future podcasts. But we will move on to our last story of the week, which is that younger audiences are more likely to get their news from influencers on their favoured social media platforms than from mainstream news outlets. That's according to the 2023 Reuters Institute Digital News Report, which found that while traditional journalism is more popular on Facebook and Twitter, networks with younger users such as TikTok, Snapchat and YouTube generally rely on personalities as their main news sources. While some legacy broadcasters have found success on newer platforms, many are wary that they don't currently offer secure monetization opportunities, per the report. Journalists have also struggled to adjust to TikTok's short-form video format, and some outlets are apparently concerned about the platform's relationship with Beijing. While the ByteDance-owned platform was identified as the fastest-growing platform for news consumption, Facebook remains the leader, despite reportedly reducing the amount of news promoted across its properties. You know, influencers have been a bit of a tricky area for brands and advertisers. There's been some, you know, concerns about their intentions or their roles on the platform and how they present themselves and present different companies. So a bit of a tricky area. Should we therefore be concerned that, you know, younger people are kind of turning to these people for, you know, their wider information sources? Natalie, what do you think?
The short answer is yes. One thing that comes to mind is, I don't know, did you guys ever watch Star Trek? Well, like Star Trek Deep Space Nine, by any chance?
Not Deep Space Nine. Sorry. I was a Voyager fan in the day.
Oh, yeah, I love Voyager. So I love all the Star Treks. But there was one, there's a species called the Ferengi in Star Trek, which are particularly brilliant species. And one of the things that comes to mind is that the male Ferengis, there's so much to unpack here, but let's not go down the route. The male Ferengis expect their food to be chewed, like masticated by the female Ferengi is kind of one of these cultural dynamics. And that was the first thing that came to my mind. Judge that as you will when thinking about this. And it's the sense that, of course, we're always consuming our news sources through the voices of other people. So whether that's a journalist who has got experience in a particular area like yourself, where you've got contextual information that's relevant, you can draw upon other areas of expertise, valued sources, you have a framework from which to understand if specific information is more valid or robust than others. Like, that seems to me like a good kind of mastication, if you like. But on the flip side, you've got people who are perhaps not critically engaged with the source material, who are then providing opinion based on, as we all are, based upon biases, ideas, perceptions, views, motivation. It's like, I just think it's going to be a total shit show, frankly. And I think there's a question around what happens when you move away from previously, and I remember growing up with this, like newspapers where maybe there's six main newspapers, you go to the newsstand and you see those six different papers on the stand, even if you're not picking up the one that most closely fits your political perspective, you can at least see the headlines. And you're working off the assumption that there is a kind of like a almost like a collective consensus on what news stories are valid, bearing in mind that these are owned by organizations that are kind of deciding what narrative to feed to people. But at least you all are exposed to the same narrative. So you can all say, okay, these are the six papers. This is what we think about each one. So you're kind of operating within the same informational architecture or territory. The problem with atomized, highly personalized sort of forms of information digestion, if you like, or gathering, is that you no longer have any kind of collective consensus on what the news actually is. So you don't have those six papers anymore to say, okay, well, this one's clearly flawed because X, Y, and Z. Suddenly, you've got millions of quote-unquote news sources that might be completely different to those of the peer next to you that you share values. So it's just, it becomes a horror show and a hall of mirrors that we have to really think about what the alternatives might be. So an example might be looking for people who have domain expertise. So you say, okay, someone's got... like Christian Amanpour, someone's got really good credentials in politics and geopolitical, relationships, whatever. And so you go for someone like that and you know that they've got credentials. So it might be a question of engaging more with specific sources in specific domains, but who has the bandwidth to actually do that? And are we teaching people in schools how to think critically? In some countries, yes, there's kind of digital literacy includes ways of assessing information for their political content, for whatever nudge or inference they might be trying to kind of embed in the person who's reading or consuming it. Again, lots of kind of things to consider, but I think in the main, it's going to be really problematic.
Yeah. I mean, just looking from, because I don't use TikTok personally, and I can't say I look to influencers for anything, let alone for news, but just from being on Instagram and even just looking at, you know, non-news kind of but broader reaching pages and looking at the kinds of the comments you can get on them and the kinds of, I guess, the assertiveness of the opinions within those comments, it can be really quite alarming, and lots of, you know, stats and sources, you know, thrown about and it you know, and conflated with fact, you know, and that's just in the comment section, you know, which not everyone reads. But then if you're coming across certain individuals with certain viewpoints and, you know, if you are of a particular persuasion, then yeah, it can lead to, you know, quite severe or, you know, really quite worrying consequences. Mm-hmm. Matt, what did you make of this story? And, you know, do you share the kind of concern that Natalie's outlined?
I do share that concern, but looking at the report itself from Reuters, which I would recommend because it's a very in-depth, very interesting read, it did soften the concern a little bit for me, because it wasn't an exclusive question respondents were asked. So respondents getting news from personalities, which was about 55%, which included not just influencers, but wider celebrities. I'm not entirely sure how you draw the line between influencer and celebrity. But they're also getting news from mainstream news outlets or journalists on the platform. That was around 33%. So there's going to be some crossover there. And Reuters themselves also pointed out that only half of news publishers are releasing content onto TikTok anyway, due to the nascency of the platform and, you know, things like concerns over Chinese government influence. So there's less content from those mainstream news outlets, and there could be restrictions from individual journalists as well as to what they can say and publish on the platform. So there could be an element of just a reflection of the platform itself rather than younger people turning specifically to influencers. What I think is more concerning within the report, and I think this links back to Natalie's points, is that at least for British publishers, then there's been a really sharp fall in the numbers of young people. So those in the 18 to 24 bracket going directly to a news site or a news app for their news in the last 4 years. It's halved to 24%, whereas for over 35s, it's still hovering above 50%. So young people, you know, this reflects global trends. More young people, according to the report, are getting their news from social media rather than directly from news websites. And obviously this raises lots of concerns regarding publisher monetization. Obviously, you know, those news outlets, they're the ones you'd think, yes, they should be producing this news. They have the expertise rather than just social media, which is a user-generated content free-for-all shit show. And it's the context of where that news is seen as well. So for example, you know, you could have, if say, as the trend is going, all news gets published to social media rather than direct news websites, you're going to have a piece of, at the moment at least, a piece of, you know, what would be classed as respectable journalism from an expert journalist appearing underneath some, as you say, Grace, some, you know, comment that utterly misses the point and is downright misleading. So yeah, there are still concerns with it, I think, in terms of that shift from social, you know, from direct news to social media. And I think there has to be some, you know, some questions from those mainstream news outlets as to what more those social media platforms can do to monetize their content, given people are primarily using social media to access it.
Yeah, it's interesting you raise the point about monetization, because, you know, we've discussed last week at ATS, you know, the role of, you know, advertising and, you know, advertiser partnerships to, you know, support publishers and news publishers specifically, so that they can fund, you know, high quality journalism that, you know, cuts out a lot of the, you know, the issues that's created by user generated content and the kind of, you know, the opinions and the baggage that kind of comes with that. So do you think that the current state of things, the current relationships between, you know, advertisers and publishers is enough to kind of set a foundation for more high quality journalism, so that, you know, there's that kind of counter to misinformation and fake news? Or do you think that there's more work to be done there?
It's a very interesting question, but I think, like, it depends on the platform, I suppose. Like, obviously, this book ends nicely with the Twitter story when they're going all down this free-for-all approach, whereas you've got some platforms that'll take a little bit more of a catered viewpoint. But you are seeing YouTube's rode back on its policies regarding misinformation around electoral fraud, which, going into a US election, is going to be a delight of a decision, I'm sure. So yeah, whether we have that basis for it now, I'm not necessarily sure. But I think, you know, if, you know, this migration did continue, I'm sure at some point from users there'd be pushback to go, hang on, we need, you know, if all we need a source of quality journalism. So I think there will be consolidation, and I think there would be user pushback if everything kind of went down that social media route. But yeah, I don't necessarily have a crystal ball, so I'm not 100% sure how that's going to play out.
To have a crystal ball, that would be make a very different podcast. Natalie, I'll finish with you for kind of to wrap up our News of the Week discussion. What do you think about, I suppose, trust is a big element? You know, as Matt said, the publication of news on social media has come up as a, you know, people are recognizing that there are algorithms kind of directing them to certain stories, etc. Do you think that people generally have a healthy level of trust in the kind of news they're being presented with? Or do you think that trust is still a really big issue and it's going to require kind of more intervention and more work by, you know, these big companies, social media platforms, publishers, etc., to kind of level out perhaps this news consumption or these consumption habits?
If we look through kind of the reports from Edelman's Trust Barometer over the last few years, trust has been on a precipitous decline across various different categories, including media. And I think if you compound that with the fact that most people, myself included, use social media as a way to shift our internal state. So when do you whip out, you know, your phone to check on TikTok or Instagram, whatever? It's when maybe you're feeling bored or you're not sleepy, so you want something to fill the time, or you're feeling anxious. It's generally to alleviate some kind of dysphoric state. And so we're not using it to find, in the main, we're not using it principally to find quality sources of news information. The way that the platforms are designed are to elicit almost like Pavlovian responses, where we're seeking that dopamine hit, which is fleeting and unsatisfying, to get us into this repetitive behavior of reward seeking, basically. And I think that that kind of internal subjective context is not particularly compatible with slowed down, critical, laborious, effortful thinking. Like, is the stuff that I'm consuming actually qualified? Who's produced this? Is there a primary source that's been cited? Like, I think the very fact that news is being disseminated and propagated across platforms that are not designed to help us engage critically is a problem. And that's going to be, for me, one of the biggest questions around how do we make sure that we engage people? And again, this is the question, do we want to? And by we, who's the we, right? Like, do we have a system in which the powers that create the content, so some providers are much more aligned with ethical journalism than others, let's say, do we have enough of those organizations saying, actually, we need to find new models to get information out to empower people to make more informed decisions, versus other organizations, I'm thinking about some big US organizations, that just want to maximize profits, drive engagement. So again, it's competing needs that decide what gets shared, upon which platforms they get shared. And I think there's an interesting question around how much do people care about the truth of what they're consuming, when the truth can be unpleasant and can cause friction and discomfort. And we're living in a society where increasingly we don't, I'm going to make a generalization here, but I think we're not as resilient perhaps as we used to be to exposing ourselves to information that that contradicts our existing worldviews. And so if you're in a system where you have to think more about what you're reading, seek out alternative points of views, it's emotionally, psychologically costly to do it, the world is going to shit because it's kind of these polycrises, your future is fucked, AI's taken all the jobs. Like, really, are you going to spend the time, effort, whatever, in reading stuff that's probably going to be depressing anyway? I'm not a pessimist about the overall trajectory of humanity, but at this moment in time, with all of the stuff that I'm seeing across social channels, like Quorkor in the States, which is a trending topic among young people who want to come out of capitalism, all this kind of stuff, there is a huge disenchantment with and futility around the future that we potentially face, and a sense of, well, how on earth are we going to change it when the structures are so vast that we're not going to be able to make change in time for what? Anyway, so it's a big question. I think we need new alternative systems, which are probably being trotted out. You know, Polis is a good example in Taiwan for creating collaborative forms of engagement and democratic process. So these things exist. They are out there. We can look to them and draw inspiration and build our own. But I think we need systemic change. And hopefully, as Matt says, people at some point are going to go, I've had enough of this. Let's do something differently. And through grassroots systems and perhaps legislation in some countries who are doing differently, we'll be able to pivot away to something that's much more generative for humanity as a whole. That's my hope.
It's a shared hope.
That was a bit of a waffle. Sorry.
No, not at all. I mean, as I've said, you know, there is so much philosophically to unpack around, you know, the systems that we generally kind of, you know, look to specifically for, you know, as you've said, mindless entertainment, and also that, you know, are very, you know, key areas for advertising. And, you know, I think we don't really talk about or really delve into the philosophical aspects, and but it's so important to do so. So thank you so much for your for your takes. We'll leave the news of the week stories there and talk to you a bit more, Natalie, about what you're working on, what's going on with you. So your first book, Webs of Influence, came out originally, it was published in 2012, and yeah, you've published a second edition more recently. But how, if at all, have you kind of seen the persuasiveness of online advertising changing since, you know, you first released the book?
Well, I think the thing that comes to mind now is that beyond creating user experiences that are designed by humans for other people based on historic data and can nudge people, whether that's the content that people get, you know, delivered or, you know, whatever it might be, that's kind of, there's a transparency almost to that kind of process where you can pinpoint what's happened when. I think now the thing that I'm most curious and concerned about in terms of influence and nudging is what happens when we enter into what some people describe as synthetic relationship with AI. So Tristan Harris and Asa Raskin talk about this quite a bit. And there's a sense that if you can engage with what I think we kind of incorrectly misname a chatbot, which is essentially at its most sophisticated, an always on 24-hour available confidant, potentially, system that we find difficult to distinguish from a human other. So we've got these anthropomorphized systems that are constantly available to us, that learn what's important to us, that will always give us attention, that reflect back our language. And we know that mirroring is an important way to build rapport. We've got systems now that exist like this that could potentially, if they're programmed in a particular way, or there aren't guardrails put into place, whether it's intentional or kind of through omission, can lead people to unexpected places where they then end up making choices they otherwise wouldn't had they not engaged with the chatbot. So one example was in the news, I think it was last month, there was this really tragic story of a man, a Belgian chap in his early 30s with a family, who was suffering from quite severe eco-anxiety and engaged with a chatbot over the course of, I believe it was several weeks. And at some point, the question arises, well, if the world is kind of falling apart, what's the point in me living if my existence is causing a greater impact for harm than for good? And through the conversation with this chatbot, he ends up, I don't know if it's through this, attribution is a tricky thing, but he ends up taking his own life. And people start questioning, well, hang on, how much was his conversations at 3-4 in the morning with his chatbot influencing his subjective experience? And what does it mean to have a system where synthetic relationships such as these can influence people at a really profound level? And so that for me is the biggest question. What on earth are we going to do about that? And then if you're talking about, it's kind of like in the film Her, where there's an OS that can be in conversation with hundreds of thousands or millions of people at the same time. If that gets hacked, then you could have highly personalized synthetic relationships with people all over the world, where their behaviors, perspectives, views are getting nudged down particular paths that could cause huge issues further down the line politically. And we know how weak humanity is in relationship to rapidly changing situations where there's precarity, scarcity, inequality, poverty. You know, look through history. Those are the prime conditions within which it's very easy to seed division and suffering. And we're just kind of turbocharging that. I have a lot of concern around that.
With all that in mind, what role do you think that participants, you know, within online spheres, you know, who are involved in persuasion, so publishers and advertisers, what responsibilities do they have and what role should they kind of be conscious of playing with all of this in mind?
That's such a good question. I mean, I think one thing that I would like to see as someone who reads news would be an easy to digest, concise, transparent synopsis of the values that particular publishing body adheres to, so that I know the frame of reference for all of the stuff that I'm consuming. And the tricky thing here is to make sure that it's enough information that people have a detailed enough and realistic understanding about the orientation and perspective and motivations of the organizations, but also in a way that's easy to digest, so you're not giving people extra cognitive load. Like, you're not making it hard. Like with cookies, we have to go through a gazillion cookies. You're like, just let me just, like, don't track me, or track me, or the middle one, which is essentials only. It doesn't need to be more than that. So some sort of system where you can fairly swiftly understand what you're going in for. I think the other thing that would be really interesting, and this is where it gets into more challenging territory, is to replicate the variety of perspectives available at the newsstand in apps that provide news. So it could be something like you would have, and I'm just playing around here, organizations that publish news on, let's say, the right of the political system, the center and the left, and that those would always be displayed no matter what within an app, so that you could easily scan as part of your entrance into the app what's being talked about across other platforms. Now, I don't know if you'd want to legislate for this. I don't know, because then it's like, who has the right to tell me what to consume, what not to consume? So it's wrought with, again, complex philosophical questions. But I think something like that, where we're making it easier for people to locate themselves and the publishing platform within a wider ecosystem of perspectives, would give us at least the kind of ongoing sense that this is one perspective of many. It's not the only truth. I can be challenged. There are other places to look for other ideas. So I think some form of system that builds that in could be one way to approach it. But I'm just riffing here. What do you guys think?
No, I mean, I agree. It's something that we've, especially to your point about, you know, cookies and the kind of obfuscation that goes on there and the kind of the lack of transparency. It's a massive, massive issue within the industry itself. And obviously the outcome is that, you know, there is, as we mentioned in the last story, this kind of lack of trust and a lack of engagement with, you know, more traditional, you know, publishers and advertisers and, you know, the people who've kind of been there from the beginning and are maybe more reliable, maybe not all, but, you know, and that obviously has a massive, you know, knock on effect. Just finally, so your next book came out a couple of years ago, which focuses on, it's Business Unusual, and that focuses on how kind of brands and businesses have been adjusting after the pandemic and the turmoil, shall we say, of recent years. What was the biggest takeaway for you from writing that book, and kind of what have you hoped it's achieved?
So I think one of the most profound threads that I encountered during writing the book was around how we can make decisions from a deeper set of principles. So often people will talk about psychometrics and personality as a way to predict consumer behavior or to adjust marketing messages so they are more engaging or resonant with a particular audience. As I've gotten older, I've thought more about how we shape the world around us and perhaps how we embody values that will make us better ancestors than we might otherwise be if we just always follow a profit motive. And so I was very interested in how do we orient ourselves towards these deeper values, which are perhaps seated around things like reducing suffering or a sense of universal benevolence or a sense of self-determination. How do you give people greater agency or skill or a sense of belonging? And I think when we're thinking about change and volatility and uncertainty, resilience and values come up time and again as being very closely intertwined, no matter what the issue is, whether it's a pandemic, whether it's a disruption from AI or climate and biodiversity challenges, let's say. And so really I've become, since that book, much more interested in how do we anchor ourselves in values, in community, so that we're much better able to face into, understand and withstand the complex situations that we face, so that we can then, from a place of connection, come up with better, more creative and imaginative solutions. So it's kind of facing into the reality of the situation whilst retaining agency and a vision of what can happen differently. So it's kind of tapping into the imaginal. So I think from that perspective, I'm much more interested now in the role of art and music and community, and especially in the face of automation. What are the qualities that make us unique and connected to a deeper sense of aliveness that technology perhaps seeks to strip away? So it's kind of, it's that. I'm interested in that fundamental question. Yeah.
And an incredibly important and very, very deep question it is, you know, it's yeah, a lot to wrap your head around, really.
Yeah. And it's one of the reasons why I'm like on the podcast, which I think I'm going to rebrand. It's called The Hive Podcast, but it's probably going to move to be called In Conversation with Natalie Nahai, because there's so many hives now that like you just can't find it. So In Conversation with Natalie Nahai will be the new name in the next month or so. But drawing upon other people's creativity and expertise to start to map out and navigate some of these pathways, because there are many and we're only going to get through it if we do it together. So, yeah.
Collaboration's key.
Totally.
Well, this has honestly been such a fascinating chat. I've really, really enjoyed it, and I'd love to keep going, but we are out of time. So thank you so much, Natalie, for your perspective on all three stories and telling us more about your work. It's honestly been really, really insightful. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you, Matt, for your insight. As always, it's always great to have you.
Thank you, Grace. And just to echo you, Grace, thanks ever so much, Natalie. That was really fascinating. And yeah, cage fighting, Star Trek and mastication. What more could you want from a podcast?
The headlines are going to be exceptional. And the keywords as well. Watch the space. Hashtag Ferengi.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.